Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Regarding this bloating about our president, it's a joke. It's more lies. I can't just say because my son was tortured, these indictments came. It's lies over lies.
We take a look at the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, the U.S. citizen who spent nearly 2 years in a Saudi prison without charge. He was returned to the United States this week, now stands accused of plotting to kill the president. Then we take a look at Taser International. They've announced a major campaign to market a new model of the Taser weapon to consumers. We'll speak with Bill Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International. The group has a new report called Excessive and Lethal Force: Deaths and Ill Treatment Involving Police Use of Tasers. Then we go to Israel to speak with the U.S. peace activist Brian Avery. He was shot in the face, he says, by Israeli forces in Jenin in 2003. He's returned to Israel for the first time, calling for an investigation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is back in the United States after wrapping up his European tour. The multi-country trip was a tightly scripted affair, and large demonstrations against Bush were kept far away from any of the official events. Last night, Bush met for 2 hours with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Bratislava, Slovakia. At a news conference after the summit, Bush criticized Russia on issues of freedom of the press, freedom of dissent, and protection of minorities. Here is Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Russia has made its choice in favor of democracy 14 years ago, independently, without any pressure from outside. It made that decision in the interests of itself, in the interests of its people, of its citizens. This is our final choice, and we have no way back. There can be no return to what we used to have before. And the guarantee for this is the choice of the Russian people themselves. No guarantees from outside cannot be provided. This is impossible. It would be impossible for Russia today. Any kind of turn towards totalitarianism for Russia would be impossible due to the condition of the Russian society.
President Vladimir Putin, the Russian press blasted President Bush's comments as hypocritical. At yesterday's news conference, Bush made what were perhaps his most extensive comments on his view of the media. His statements came as a response to a Russian reporter who questioned the freedom of the U.S. press.
I think it's important. Any viable democracy has got a free and active press. Obviously, if you're a member of the Russian press, you feel like the press is free. And that's feel that way? That's good. I mean, but I talked to Vladimir about that, and he wanted to know about our press. I said, nice bunch of folks, and he wanted to know about as you mentioned, the subject of somebody getting fired. People do get fired in American press. They don't get fired by government, however. They get fired by their editors, or they get fired by their producers, or they get fired by the owners of a particular outlet or network. But a free press is important, and it is an important part of any democracy. And if you're a member of the press corps and you feel comfortable with the press in Russia, I think that is a pretty interesting observation for those of us who don't live in Russia to listen to. But no question, whether it be in America or anywhere else, the sign of a healthy and vibrant society is one in where there's an active press corps. Obviously, there is got to be constraints. I mean, there's got to be truth. People got to tell the truth. And if somebody violates the truth, then those who own a particular newspaper or those who are in charge of a particular electronic station need to hold people to account. The press, the capacity of the press to hold people to account also depends on their willingness to self-examine at times when they're wrong. And that happens on occasion in America. And that's an important part of maintaining a proper relationship between government and press.
President Bush speaking on Thursday in Slovakia. In the closing speech of his 4 days of meetings, Bush celebrated the upheavals in Ukraine and Georgia, where Moscow and Washington were on opposing sides. Bush also predicted similar events would take place in Belarus and in Moldova, the poorest country in Europe and the only one governed by a communist party. It goes to the polls next week. This news from Italy. Pope John Paul II last night underwent successful surgery to his windpipe after being rushed to the hospital for the second time in a month with what the Vatican describes as acute respiratory difficulties. His spokesperson said the 30-minute tracheotomy was conducted without problem and his condition is described as serene and tranquil. He's breathing with the aid of a respirator. This according to the Italian media. The tracheotomy will prevent him from speaking for more than brief periods and may require a prolonged hospital stay. The Vatican has played down the procedure, calling the tracheotomy elective. But outside doctors say it's likely a result of pneumonia, which is particularly life-threatening for elderly patients with Parkinson's. The New York Times is reporting that 10 of the 32 government drug advisors who last week endorsed continued marketing of the controversial painkillers Celebrex, Bextra, and Vioxx have consulted in recent years for the makers of those very drugs. The report's based on disclosures in medical journals and other public records. If the 10 advisors had not cast their votes, the committee would have voted 12-8 that Bextra should be taken off the market and 14-8 that Vioxx should not be allowed back on the shelves. The 10 advisors with company ties voted 9-1 to keep Bextra on the market and 9-1 for Vioxx's return. According to studies, the painkillers are responsible for tens of thousands of deaths. 8 of the 10 members told the New York Times their past relationships with the drug companies had not influenced their vote. A Brazilian environmentalist has been shot dead days after gunmen killed the U.S. nun who campaigned to protect the Amazon rainforest from loggers and ranchers vying for its natural resources. Authorities said Wednesday that Dionisio Ribeiro was shot in the head late Tuesday at the Tingua Nature Reserve near Rio de Janeiro. Colleagues say Ribeiro had received death threats for some time because of his efforts to stop poaching and the illegal felling of palm trees. Ribeiro's murder follows the recent shooting deaths of Sister Dorothy Stang, an environmental activist and advocate for the poor, and Daniel Suarez da Costa, an advocate of landless peasants. Back in the United States, the first congressional study on the impact of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy has just been released. It says hundreds of highly skilled troops, including many translators, have left the armed forces because of the Pentagon's rules on gay men and lesbians, costing taxpayers nearly $200 million. The estimated cost was for recruiting and training replacements from 1994 to through 2003 for more than 9,400 troops discharged from the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine Corps because of the policy. The study by the General Accountability Office was released on Thursday. Congress approved Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 93. It allows gay men and lesbians to serve as long as they don't disclose their sexual orientation. Of those who left, 757 held critical jobs for which the Pentagon offers reenlistment bonuses because of their specialized nature, such as data processing technicians and translators. Many who were discharged had intelligence-related jobs. Also, 322 spoke foreign languages, including Arabic, Farsi, Korean, and Mandarin, which the Pentagon has called critical skills amid threats from terrorists. December 12th, soldiers expelled from the military because of their sexual orientation sued the government, citing a Supreme Court ruling that state laws making gay sex a crime were unconstitutional. The Bush administration has asked a federal court to dismiss the suit. And Democratic Congressmember Maurice Hinchey of New York says he believes President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, is behind the fake documents that brought down several top executives at CBS. Hinchey said, quote, "I have my own beliefs about how that happened." He said it originated with Karl Rove and my belief in the White House. Once they did that, then it undermined everything else about Bush's draft dodging that had the effect of taking the whole issue away, Hinchey said. The documents in question address Bush's military service in Alabama in 72 while on leave from the Texas National Guard. Ultimately, CBS could not prove that the memos were authentic. Ooh.
strange purse stuffed nervous with gold. Can you be where you want to be? Walk down any street find. Look at any clock, tell it time. Sing some strange verse from some strange song of mine. You'll be where you want to be. No, I can't sing till she brings a sound to life. And I blend with kings, would never change a thing. Who knows anything?
Wilco, When You Wake Up Feeling Old, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you out there watching on television or listening on the radio. Today we take a look at the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, the U.S. citizen who spent nearly 2 years in a Saudi prison without charge before being returned to the United States, where he now stands accused of plotting to kill the president. This is his story. Ahmed Omar Abu Ali was born in Houston and raised in Virginia. In 1999, he graduated as valedictorian of the Islamic Saudi Academy in Alexandria. He moved to Saudi Arabia the following year to continue his religious studies. In June of 2003, the Saudi government, apparently acting in consultation with U.S. officials, arrested Abu Ali while he was taking his final exams at the Islamic University of Medina. Even though he was never charged with the crime, Abu Ali remained in a Saudi jail for the next 20 months, where he was reportedly tortured.
His parents claim that he was being held at the behest of the U.S. government and sued in court to get him returned to the United States. This past December, federal judge John Bates wrote an opinion, quote, "There's been at least some circumstantial evidence that Abu Ali has been tortured during interrogations with the knowledge of the United States." Abu Ali was flown to the United States this week, where the Justice Department accused him of plotting to assassinate President Bush with members of Al-Qaeda. The indictment charged Abu Ali, quote, "discuss plans to kill the president, either by shooting him or detonating a car bomb." The plot apparently never advanced beyond the talking stage. If convicted of all charges, Abu Ali faces up to 80 years in prison. In a subsequent filing Wednesday, federal prosecutors asked that Abu Ali remain in jail pending trial. They also revealed another interesting fact. The only other witness to the alleged conversations Abu Ali took part in was killed in September 2003. Also in the filing, the Justice Department denied Abu Ali was tortured in Saudi Arabia and said he never made any claims of abuse to U.S. officials as he was being returned. Abu Ali's family is planning to pursue a lawsuit accusing the administration of being behind their son's detention. After the indictment, Abu Ali's mother spoke to reporters outside the courtroom.
Regarding this blotting about our president, it's a joke. It's more lies. I can't just say because my son was tortured, these indictments came. It's lies over lies.
Fatin Abu Ali, the mother of Ahmed Abu Ali. The attorney in the criminal case, Edward McMahon, spoke moments later.
I'm somewhat saddened by the thought that it's come to the position now that our government apparently is prepared to use evidence that's been produced by torture in a criminal case in the United States of America.
We're joined on the phone right now in Washington by Abu Ali's other lawyer, David Cole. He's professor at Georgetown Law School and author of the book Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedom in the War on Terrorism. He represents the Abu Ali family in their habeas corpus petition challenging Ahmed's detention in Saudi Arabia. We're also joined by Shakar El-Sayed, a friend of the Abu Ali family and a member of the executive committee of the Islamic Center, where Ahmed Omar Abu Ali went to pray. We start with David Cole. Can you explain this case, why he was imprisoned in Saudi Arabia and how you got him back to the United States?
Well, he was arrested in Saudi Arabia at the same time that three other Americans were arrested in Saudi Arabia. The three others were brought back to the United States for trial in conjunction with the Virginia paintball case, a case involving an alleged conspiracy to provide material support to a terrorist group in the Kashmir. One of his closest friends was one of the people brought back and was acquitted on all charges. But apparently the government didn't have enough evidence to charge Ahmed Abu Ali with the paintball charges. And so while his name came up in the case at various points, they never charged him. But instead they let the Saudis keep him locked up, and they participated in his interrogation while he was locked up in Saudi Arabia, and were apparently content to just leave him locked up there for as long as they could. When we filed a lawsuit challenging that detention and charging that he was being held at the behest of the United States, and a judge ordered that the government disclose to us the evidence concerning its arrangements with Saudi Arabia on the holding of this U.S. citizen, at that point, the government went through incredible lengths to try to stop having to provide that information, including filing motions to dismiss entirely in secret with all the argument and all the evidence in secret. And ultimately, they indicted him, brought him back here to the United States, and now at least he'll face a public trial.
Now, when he was being held in Saudi Arabia, was he under Saudi charges at all? And did the U.S. government, if it had some involvement, recognize that he has some kind of right to at least an attorney while he was being held there?
No. I mean, this is a remarkable thing. He was never charged with anything in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, you would think that if a U.S. citizen were locked up for, you know, a month, a week, without charges in a foreign country, there would be protest. We would be filing protests. We would be making a stink, et cetera. No, instead, what we were doing was we were, you know, sending the FBI over to observe and participate in his interrogation. We weren't making any protests or lodging any protests whatsoever. He was not entitled to an attorney while he was there. He didn't see a single person while he was there, except for his Saudi interrogators and the U.S. consular official who would occasionally go and visit him. That was it. He was, you know, effectively held incommunicado, and not a protest was filed, and no action was taken until the federal judge in the United States was you know, on the verge of ordering the government to disclose the nature of its arrangement with Saudi Arabia on this case.
The charge, the allegation that Ahmed Abu Ali was tortured, his lawyer in court said he would show the judge, saying he would pick up his shirt. And the AP report quotes his father outside the courtroom, Omar Abu Ali, saying he knew his son was being tortured at the Al-Air prison in Riyadh because of the words the young man blurted out in his first phone call home after being arrested. "I've been on a long trip in a wild jungle," Omar Abu Ali said his son told him. The father said he was terrified by the call because he knew it was code for being tortured. We're joined, as I said, in addition to David Cole, we are joined by a family friend, Shakar El-Sayed. Can you talk about these charges of torture and what he was telling his family?
First call that came, the first question that
if you could speak as loud as you possibly can, it's okay. Very hard. Oh, that's perfect.
Okay. The first call that came, the family, the father and the mother
were pressing Ahmed to tell them about his well-being. They didn't hear from him for 2 months since he was arrested. So the first question was, how are you doing? How's your well-being? How's your health? Are you okay? And the first statement that he came up with is, consider me in a long journey in a wild jungle, was really a very strong reason for them to freak out. They really couldn't, you know, say anything. They told them, you know, take care of yourself, you will be safe, and try to be strong and give him some support. But that was very stunning. But it was known all along that Ahmed was held incommunicado for three periods in his incarceration. The first 2 months, then from in September 2003 for three other months, and that was the time when four FBI agents went to interrogate Ahmed for about a full week of interrogation. Very extensive interrogation. Ahmed did not talk back to his family because he was again put in solitary confinement for three consecutive months. Between the two periods, Ahmed was talking to his family every 2 weeks, regularly, on regular basis, every other Saturday. The time was different every time, but Saturday was the day they waited the call every 2 weeks. Then the third time that he was also in incommunicado detention was the period between November 20 until he was extradited to the United States. So these are three periods. You count 2 months, 3 months, and about three more months. Those about 50% of the period, and he only spoke once before he was extradited, and he did not know at that time anything about his extradition or any information about what was going on. But at that time, the U.S. government had already set in motion, after the judge in D.C. Established for them very clearly that he was not going to take seriously their motion to dismiss on secret evidence, and he was asking them to bring whatever that bears on their case from their perspective. They filed nothing when the due date came. Professor Call filed the answer to the dismissal motion, which was very strong and very impressive. And the government knew they were losing the case in D.C.
If I can ask you just for 1 second, you are a longtime friend of Ahmed's. Could you tell us a little bit about him and what about the government charges that he did participate in training in al-Qaeda camps? Is there any validity to that at all? And could you tell us a little bit about him as a person?
Ahmed is a very, very pleasant person. I knew him before he was born because we were neighbors for over 20 years. Ahmed is a very nice person, very sociable. He throws jokes, he plays with kids, he spends time helping people. He participated in interfaith activities. He lives in an apartment complex where winter came, Ahmed would be the first one to pick the elderly cars and clean it from snow and other things. He was this kind of person, a civic person, a very respectful person. Listen to this. We reached out to the community to tell them, listen, Ahmed's bail is coming. And we got literally tens of people coming with their homes, with their jewelry, with their money, saying, we love him. He's our son. This is how much confidence and trust the community has in him.
We're also joined on the line by David Cole. At this point, what happens?
Well, at this point, you know, he's facing serious criminal charges, that I think it's going to be very difficult for the government to actually prove up, because if you look at the indictment, it consists almost entirely of statements from or paraphrases of allegations from unidentified quote-unquote co-conspirators, all of whom are in Saudi Arabia and are presumably Saudis who were captured and interrogated by the Saudis. So I think the first question in the case is going to be, you know, can the government proceed with a criminal indictment of a U.S. citizen who it had locked up by another country for 20 months without charges. Can it do that consistent with the Due Process Clause of the Constitution? Can it do that consistent with the Speedy Trial Act? The next question is going to be, if they can go forward at all, can they rely on any evidence that they obtained from the Saudi intelligence service, a service which is well known, been accused by the United States repeatedly of engaging in torture as a routine matter of interrogation. So I think that this, you know, there was a statement in the Washington Post quoting a government official who said they would have preferred to have left Ahmed in Saudi Arabia rather than bring him in and charge him here because their case against him is so thin. I think we'll see that as we go forward.
Finally, I wanted to ask Shekhar El-Sayed. There was a piece in the New York Times that said Mr. Abu Ali's case and his alleged ties to terrorism have focused renewed attention on the Islamic Saudi Academy, the school in suburban Washington from which he graduated as valedictorian in 1999. The school, founded in 84 for the children of expatriate Saudis, has come under scrutiny before because of accusations of extremism and possible terrorism against other alumni employees. And then it says, quotes a letter to the Saudi ambassador by Senator Charles Schumer, the Democrat of New York, who is pressing for answers about the school's finances and whether it has ties to extremism. Can you respond to that?
I can say one thing. The campaign against Saudi Arabia, the campaign to portray Islam in all its sources, methods, shapes, and shades as an extreme religion that teaches violence and so on and so forth, is a media and government campaign to justify the next upcoming policy change towards Saudi Arabia. You know that the United States withdrew its bases from Saudi Arabia and moved to Qatar. The CENTCOM now is in Qatar. And there is a shift, and that shift has to be justified. And, of course, there are apparent reasons to push in that direction, that the 15 hijackers among the 19 came from Saudi Arabia. But I can tell you that the school where my own children go to is neither an extremist school nor does it teach extremism. More than 60% of the teachers there are non-Muslims. It's just inconceivable that the media is so blinded by the wave and unwilling to be critical. And I believe also Senator Schumer, unfortunately, has his own ties to the Jewish lobby and the Zionist lobby. And I'm not sure that any of this could not be taken, or rather could be taken without a grain of salt.
Finally, David Cole, final comment.
Well, I think there's a real. You have to ask, what has our country come to when it locks up its own citizens abroad in order to avoid any kind of significant judicial review? It then charges them with the statements of dead people involving conversations and no more. What have we come to in the war on terror? Is this how far the government is pushing to try to make show results in its efforts?
Well, David Cole and Shekhar El-Sayed, I want to thank you both for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by the executive director of Amnesty International, Bill Schultz, in our studio. We'll talk about their latest report on tasers. Stay with us.
Father, out of the weekend, and deceitful is a
culture. See them come here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV stations, and on PBS stations, as well as both satellite TV networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. Our TV broadcasts are closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, earlier this month, Taser International, the maker of Taser electric shock weapons, announced that they will begin a major campaign to market a new model of the weapon to consumers. Currently, 95% of Taser's weapons are sold to law enforcement agencies in the United States. Tasers are shaped like handguns and administer a 50,000-volt shock by shooting someone from a distance or by applying the weapon directly to the skin. Taser made this announcement despite growing concerns over the safety and use of the weapons by police forces around the country. The weapon has become increasingly popular in police agencies who claim that lives are saved by using a taser rather than a regular firearm. Taser International declined our request for an interview, but this is what Orange County, Florida Sheriff Kevin Berry had to say about his department's use of tasers at a conference sponsored by the company in Orlando in 2003.
I can tell you that the Orange County Sheriff's Office in the late 2000 had six test and evaluation tasers. Since then, we bought 500 more tasers. And if things look good at the end of the year budget, we're going to go to full implementation. Now, I'll also tell you that since we've put the tasers on the street, we've dropped our injuries to deputies by 80%. And folks, for the administrators in this room or the training people, you need to go back and make sure that this tool is properly placed in your use of force matrix. Don't put it out there all the way to deadly force, or you won't get the results. You need to put in it, when that sucker wants to fight, it's time to put him down. We went from 13 use of firearms situations in the year 2000 to 4 in 2001, and I went 15 months without a shooting. And let me make one thing perfectly clear. The taser is fabulous. Absolutely a great tool.
Yes, Orange County, Florida Sheriff Kevin Berry speaking 2003. On Thursday, the Orange County Sheriff's Department told Democracy Now! They're reviewing their policy on the use of taser weapons. Amnesty International has documented more than 80 taser-related deaths since 99, 60% of which occurred in the last year. Amnesty's called for a suspension of the use of taser until it can be determined if they're killing people. In an Amnesty report entitled Excessive and Lethal Force, Deaths and Ill-Treatment Involving Police Use of Tasers, the human rights group concluded that, quote, far from being used to avoid lethal force, many U.S. police agencies are deploying tasers as a routine force option to subdue non-compliant or disturbed individuals who don't pose a serious danger to themselves or others. They've been used against unruly school children, mentally disturbed or intoxicated individuals, unarmed suspects fleeing minor crime scenes, and people who fail to comply immediately with a command. We're joined now by the executive director of Amnesty International, William Schultz. Welcome to Democracy
Pleasure
Now.
To be with you.
Well, can you talk about this report?
Amnesty International does not oppose tasers across the board. There may well be circumstances where police should use tasers instead of using handguns or wooden batons. The problem is that police have been convinced by Taser International that these are non-lethal weapons. The result is that the police are using them far too frequently in situations that they would never have used lethal weapons in before, against 6-year-old school children, against 71-year-old grandmothers. They're using them far too frequently, and these weapons may well be killing people. They may well not be lethal. Just this past week,
They may well be lethal.
Just this past week, the Summit County Medical Examiner in Ohio linked tasers to the death of an individual who had been tased three times by the Akron police. Taser International says there's no connection. It says these people would have died anyway. But we have at least 12 medical examiners or pathologists saying, we think there may well be a question. And all that Amnesty is saying is very simple. Let's find out. Let's have an independent medical examination systematically determine whether these are dangerous weapons or not. And if they are dangerous, then let's have the police adopt appropriate protocols, guidelines, and restrictions for their use.
Now, your report documents cases where people who were subjected to being shot with tasers ended up dying. But do you touch on the issue that some police forces raise, that the use of tasers had led to a reduction of the amount of lethal force used, in other words, firearms being shot at individuals? Although I know it's hard to compare, but has there been a significant reduction in the use of lethal methods by police?
Well, I think until we know whether indeed tasers are also a lethal weapon, it's hard to tell the answer to that question. What we know for sure is that a police department that might have its officers drawing their guns out of their holsters, their handguns, six times a month, may well now be tasing someone 1,000 times a month. Now, if tasers are in fact designed to be non-lethal alternatives to the use of force, why is it that time and again we are seeing tasers used in circumstances that police would never have used handguns or wooden batons?
Go ahead. In terms of this whole issue of now tasers being marketed to the public in general and for $1,000 a piece, what are the restrictions that already exist on the books in various states on this?
Well, in most states, there are virtually no restrictions. It's true that in some states, if you buy a taser from a gun shop, you have to go through a background check. On the other hand, you can buy an M18 taser off the internet without any kind of background check whatsoever. And so we face a situation where absolutely anyone can buy a taser without training, without having to be forced to go through any kind of restrictive regimen at all, can use them against their children. We've seen this happen already. Use them against their spouses, against their elderly parents, against the police. And this is one reason that Amnesty joins with most police departments in calling for the absolute ban on sale of tasers to civilians. Hmm.
Can you explain what tasers and stun guns are and how they're alike and how they're different?
Well, a taser is a weapon that fires a dart that is attached to a wire from the gun to the victim, to the subject, and the prongs of the arrow, of the end of the taser embed themselves in the body of the victim, such that an electric shock of up to 50,000 volts is sustained. For the police version, it is a 5-second shock, but it can be repeated any number of times. And I might say parenthetically that many of the deaths we've seen are with the repeated use of tasers. The civilian versions are a little different. They inflict a 10-second shock. When you repeat it, you can shock for up to 30 seconds with the civilian version of tasers. It's even in that sense a tougher weapon than the police weapon. Stun guns don't have this connecting wire. They often have to be applied directly to the body and therefore can't be applied at a distance.
What about this campaign? And I'm sorry Taser didn't join us, offer up a representative, but what about Taser's campaign now to push tasers to civilians, to consumers?
Well, I personally, Amnesty International, finds that outrageous. As I say, there may well be some circumstances under which, for the police, it's a very appropriate alternative to the use of a handgun. Obviously, Amnesty would rather see someone taken down through an electric shock that doesn't do any harm than through a gun that can kill the person. Of course that's true. That's common sense. But Taser is clearly misrepresenting the nature of its weapon, and it's now trying to propagate this weapon throughout the population. I think we have enough child abuse and spousal abuse and attacks on the police without giving the public still one more weapon.
We're also joined on the phone by John Burris, who's a civil rights attorney representing the family of Greg Salisbury, killed by police with taser guns in January of this year in Pacifica, California. Burris is also looking into representing families of two other victims killed by tasers. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah, good morning.
Could you tell us the circumstances of your client's of death as a result of a taser shooting?
Yes. Gregory Salisbury, African-American male, 30 years old, was at home with his family. He was acting bizarre, to say the least. The family was very concerned about his mental and emotional welfare. He was being sort of contained within a family room. When the father of Gregory Salisbury asked the family to call the paramedics, specifically to call paramedics so that he can get some medical treatment. Within about 3 to 5 minutes, the police arrived at the door without the paramedics. The family advised the police that they did not need their assistance, they needed paramedics. The police basically said, we're going to handle this first, and young Gregory looked up, saw the police, when he stood up, and when he did that, the police bum-rushed him, if you will, attacked him, jumped on top of him, three or four officers, and they immediately began to taser him, and they repeatedly tased him for a period of time. The father was saying to them, what are you doing? The young boy, the young man was essentially saying, Dad, they're killing me, they're killing me. He was responding to the electrical shocks. The police ultimately removed the father from the room, and the young man died there in the room. He had been repeatedly shocked multiple times by the taser, and so we have since then, of course, looked at this whole case. I think one of the issues that's been raised is there's this argument that the person would have died anyway. You know, when I look at that, and I hear that, I have two other cases I've looked at, you find basically healthy young people, people with no previous history of heart conditions. They are either under the influence of drugs or they're very excited, they've been running, et cetera. And it raises the real question about if you know that's the case and you're giving people electrical shocks when they are in an excited situation, whether or not you should do that at all. Now, we've had a second autopsy performed on Mr. Salisbury. The results have not come back, but we certainly do not believe that this 30-year-old African-American male who otherwise was in good health would have died, notwithstanding anything, if the taser hadn't been done. Our view, that taser was inappropriately used. He was repeatedly shocked. He was unarmed. He essentially was in a closed situation. He had no weapon. He didn't have a T-shirt on. And there was no circumstances where deadly force would have been used at all. And thus, it should not have been used. There were a lot of other ways to approach this, but I think that the issue that we're seeing with the taser is that it's being used unnecessarily under circumstances to take care of every condition. And even if no deadly force would have been used, even if batons wouldn't have been used, they are essentially being substituted as a way to take care of every situation, regardless of whether or not force was warranted or not.
John Burris, civil rights attorney, and William Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International. We'll be back in a minute. Muslim Gauze, Jackal, the Invisible, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are William Schultz, the Executive Director of Amnesty International. We're also joined on the phone by John Burris, who's representing the family of a man killed after a taser gun was used on him by police. William Schultz, is Amnesty calling for a moratorium on or a ban on the police use of stun guns?
We're not
And tasers in particular.
We're calling for a moratorium on the police use of tasers until those systematic independent medical tests have been undertaken, and we know what kind of restrictions or protocols ought to be adopted by the police.
Taser, of course, is the firm that got quite a bit of attention a few months ago when Bernard Kerik was nominated by President Bush to be head of Homeland Security. He was on the board of Taser.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Apparently, he and several other executives members of the board of directors all sold their shares, their options in Taser just before a New York Times article was about to come out that would document some of these problems, and the company's stock has since had a major hit as a result of all of these allegations. Your sense of this situation, the situation of the company itself right now?
Well, I'm really not qualified to comment on the economic health of the company. Of course, Amnesty's interests here have nothing to do with whether Taser prospers or not. Ours are solely human rights related. I will say that I think that the more deaths that occur in propinquity to the time when a Taser was used on a subject, the more that happens, the more lawsuits you're going to see, the more reticence you're going to see, as we already are, on the part of police departments and city councils around this country to adopt Tasers. That's why I think it behooves Taser International to join us in calling for independent tests by something like the Institutes of Health, for example, or an independent research institute connected with the university's medical school, because I think we all need to know the truth.
To your knowledge, are there any other countries that use tasers for their local law enforcement?
Well, certainly stun guns are widely used around the world. In fact, stun guns are one of the most common instruments of torture, and Amnesty has regularly documented their use in many, many countries for the purposes of torture. And other police departments in different parts of the world do use stun guns. To the extent to which Taser International has exported tasers, I think we'd need to ask them.
John Burris, you wanted to comment.
I just want to say that there's a growing body of medical knowledge out here that really has raised real questions about the impact that the taser has on one's heart. A cardiologist here in University of California, San Francisco, was very clear that under certain circumstances, you can clearly initiate a cardiac arrhythmia in a person who is otherwise healthy, given the manner and the number of times that a taser has been issued. And I think that data is going more and more. We are seeing more in terms of pathologists. And if you have to, the important part for me as a civil rights lawyer is the city and the municipalities who are using this, are they being placed on notice? And notwithstanding what Taser is doing, municipalities ought to take another look, because they are now being placed on notice. The more these deaths occur and the more they're being employed without clear guidelines, not only to the officers themselves and some kind of protocol that sets forth, the cities themselves and police agencies are really setting themselves up for major damages, notwithstanding what Taser does, because they now have to go back to Taser and should say to Taser, you have told us these things are proper, but what about these kinds of conditions where people are dying? And what do you say about that? And tell us how this particular weapon does not create this increased risk of harm and potential death of the various people under certain kind of conditions. And so that happens, I think we're going to have a flood of lawsuits, and it's going to endanger many more cities than otherwise should be based upon this propaganda campaign that's been and this bill of goods they've been sold by Taser.
Finally, I'd like to ask William Schultz, in your study of the various Taser incidents, did you notice any racial or ethnic disparities in the use of the Taser weapon by these police departments, or is it just generally across the board excessive use?
Taser is an equal opportunity inflictor of suffering.
Mm-hmm. And children, talking about a handcuffed 9-year-old girl in Arizona who was tasered, a 6-year-old mentally disturbed boy in Florida.
That's right. We tracked a number of cases where one cannot imagine that had the police been faced with this problem, with a 6-year-old, 9-year-old, 71-year-old grandmother, that they would have drawn their guns and shot the person. If they had, there would have been an enormous outrage about that. This is a beautiful example of how the police are using these weapons too frequently and on inappropriate subjects.
Well, I want to thank you, John Burris, for joining us, civil rights attorney, representing the families of one of the people who were killed after a taser was used on them. And William Schultz, just asking you to stay for 1 minute. You have come out with a number of other reports. Particularly, I'd like to just ask you briefly about the latest in Togo and what you have found.
Well, Togo is a fascinating situation because, of course, the son of the former president seized power there with the support of the military in violation of the Togolese constitution, which called for the head of the parliament to become president. And after some pressure, united pressure by other African leaders, something that we have rarely seen before, there have begun to be some steps to reverse that. The president has announced that there will be elections. Whether they will be fair elections, we don't know yet. There certainly needs to be intervention there in the form of election monitors. The son of the president clearly wants to stay in power. But at least the African community is stepping up to the plate in this respect in ways that they haven't always before. On the other hand, they haven't yet confronted Robert Mugabe, who is perhaps a far more important despot whose reign is affecting far more people than Togo. Togo is, of course, one of the smallest countries in Africa. Zimbabwe is one of the most important countries in Africa, and it behooves the African community to be just as outspoken about Robert Mugabe's violations as it has been against those in Togo.
Well, William Schultz, I want to thank you very much for being with us. As we turn now to Israel and Palestine to speak with Brian Avery, I know Amnesty International has come out with a call for a complete investigation of the shooting of Brian Avery. Juan, maybe you can tell the story of
what
happened to Brian.
Well, in April of 2003, Brian was shot in the face by Israeli forces. His face was shattered with his tongue split in two. He has undergone a series of facial reconstruction surgeries. Witnesses said an Israeli armored personnel carrier opened fire on Avery, but Israel has denied being behind the shooting. On February 28th, the Israeli Supreme Court will hear Avery's petition demanding a criminal investigation into the shooting.
Brian Avery's returned to Israel for the first time since the shooting took place, and he joins us now on the telephone from Tel Aviv. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Brian.
Thanks a lot, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Can you talk about what happened to you and why you've returned?
Pretty much as Juan laid out, I was shot by Israeli forces in a completely unprovoked attack. And essentially left for dead. I was given no medical treatment or anything by them. And since then, I've undergone or in the process of undergoing a series of reconstructive surgeries to rebuild the damage to my face that was caused. And so at this point, now that some of the medical stuff is starting to progress and I'm getting to a better state of health, I'm very interested in basically prosecuting the soldiers for what, was a criminal act.
Now, Brian, can you describe the day that you were shot? Where exactly you were? What was happening?
Yeah, it was in Jenin, in the West Bank, and we were, I was working with the International Solidarity Movement at the time. And at the time, it was a curfew in the town, which was not very uncommon. It was very usual for us to be out on the streets during the curfew, and this was the case. At the time, it was in the afternoon. There had been some gunfire in the area, and once that had quieted down, we went outside to go see if there was any of the local medical emergency teams that needed assistance, which was some of the groups we worked with the most in that area. Because they were often harassed and prevented from doing their jobs by the Israeli military a lot. And it was, just a routine situation. We went out and, we weren't two blocks from our apartment when a Israeli convoy of two vehicles, a tank and an armored personnel carrier, drove up the street from the direction that we were walking from. And so as we heard them coming closer, we stepped off to the side of the road to let them pass by, which was, again, in, you know, a very, very typical situation for us to encounter the soldiers, even during a curfew, and for them, you know, just to pass on by, you know, really without any taking much notice of us. And so we stood to the side of the road. We put our hands out to show we didn't have any weapons and weren't in, you know, threatening them in any way. And I was wearing a fluorescent vest to, you know, try to make ourselves as visible as possible. And it's, once they drove within about 30 meters of where we're standing, they opened fire with their machine guns and continued shooting for a very long time, probably shooting about, you know, 30 rounds of ammunition, you know, which is quite a lot, you know, when you see them in action. And I was struck in the face with one of the bullets and, you know, was knocked to the ground immediately. And as soon as the soldiers finished shooting, there was another ISN member, Tobias Carlson, standing right next to me, and there were four others who were close to the scene who were able to witness the scene. And once they finished shooting, they drove off.
William Schultz is here for Amnesty International. I'd like to, your organization did a report on some of these incidents, your perspective?
Well, obviously Amnesty has grave concerns about these kinds of incidents, these kinds of attacks on civilians, the Rachel Corrie case, Brian's case, and Amnesty has called for investigations of these cases. We want to see an independent look taken at these cases. We understand that Israel, of course, has the right to defend itself, but it also has to do so within the confines of international law and standards.
And Brian, what was the response of the U.S. government to what happened to you? Did they in any way try to intercede or demand explanations from the Israeli government?
No, they did nothing of the sort. Basically, the State Department pretty much ignored it. And the context, the attempted context I had with congressional representatives, they were very sympathetic to me personally, but publicly and politically, they did not want to touch it. They you know, were too afraid it would have negative effects on their political career.
In fact, we're coming up on the anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie on March 16th, who died in Gaza, was run over, was crushed by an Israeli bulldozer. And there's a movement in this country also to put pressure on Caterpillar, which made the bulldozer that the Israeli military used. Brian Avery, final comment.
I guess, you know, I'd just like to see justice done and hope that, you know, in the process that a lot of people will begin to take a lot more aware of what Israel is doing in the territories, the fact that they are getting so much support from the U.S. government, so much, I should say, uncritical support, and that, you know, it's an issue that can be changed and there are things that people can do about it as long as they are willing to take an active role.
Well, Brian Avery, thanks very much for joining us from Israel now, first time back since being shot in Jenin. And William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International, thanks very much for braving the weather today in New York, the snowstorm, and making your way into Democracy Now! Studios. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Be in Ann Arbor on March 10th, in Madison on March 5th, and in Denver on March 4th. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.